Judges chapter 20. You may have noticed we've got a general election coming up. It may have passed you by, you may not be aware, you may not have heard anything about it, but there is a general election coming up. Ever seen these things where they rate what are the most important issues people are talking about? It's been interesting. Up until this weekend, the last couple of days, there's one thing, at least I myself, I've heard very little about, which is the whole subject of crime. And then you get something like the London Bridge terrorist attack, and all of a sudden people are talking about it so much more. They're talking about what should we do? How should we respond to terrorism? What should we do with people in prison? How long should we keep? All these sorts of questions about crime. What promises will they make about how much money they'll commit to police spending? These sorts of issues. One thing that every politician, I think, would agree with is that our society has a problem with crime, whether it's terrorism or whether it's theft or knife crime or so on. No one thinks we live in a perfect crimeless world. The difference is, what do we do about it? Where's the solution? Because there's lots of different things you can do when someone commits a crime. Think about this. Here's one for you children. Children, imagine I stole some chocolates from the co-op down the road in Nelson. What different things could happen to me? What could people do to me? What could the police do? There's probably a few different things. Go on, what could they do?
Put them in jail.
They could put me in jail. Yeah, for stealing chocolates. They could do that. I could get a fine. Go on, what were you going to say?
They could kill you.
They could kill me. Yeah. Been a while since that's happened, and it probably wasn't for stealing chocolates. But there are places where the state does kill people. Yeah, you could get a fine, you could get community service, you have to go around picking up litter. There's lots of different types of punishments people get for crimes. And now we could debate and discuss, well, which ones do we think are the best? How should we deal with people who commit crimes, whether it's theft or something else? But you know, none of them is a silver bullet. We know that, don't we? And we know that we can't stop crime. How do we stop someone murdering, for example? You know, how do we stop people doing it in the first? So much of the things we're talking about is responding after the events happened. How do we punish or rehabilitate criminals? And then, of course, there's so much stuff that isn't even classed as a crime in our country, but it's wrong. You know, lying and being rude and cheating on someone in a relationship and all sorts of things they're wrong and they're sin, but you won't get arrested for it. The police won't do anything even though they're wrong. So it's even just worth bearing this in mind, even just in the midst of a general election, our society has a sin problem that it can't solve. You won't hear politicians say something like that very often because they all want you to think that they have the answer. Vote for them and they'll change things. You know, the great thing about Judges 20 is it's a Judges 20 where you see that God does have a solution for the problem of human sin. I don't know about you, I feel as we've been going through Judges, we're now the 20th chapter of it, I feel like we've been wading in sin up to our eyeballs all the way through this book. You can't read more than a few verses before stepping in another load of sin. The variety of sin through the book has been quite staggering at times. And now it's in chapter 20. God shows us his solution for sin, but it's one of those where blink and you miss it. It's just a couple of verses in here that we're going to get to. But we've got to read through the story to get to that point. I've not got any points for you tonight. You know, sometimes I say I've got 3 points and I might even have some alliteration for you. I don't have that tonight. We're just going to walk through the story and we're going to draw out that solution when we get to it. So verse 1, this is a long story, I'm aware of that, but we can follow the flow of it. Verse 1, the whole nation, the children of Israel, gathers together, and when it says from Dan to Beersheba, this is the equivalent of saying from Land's End to John O'Groats. You know, from one end of the country to the other end of the country. And if you're one of those people who's going to come and tell me that John O'Groats isn't actually the northernmost point, no, don't, I know, but They're all gathered together. Verse 1, it talks about the congregation. And when it uses that word, that's a legal term because it's reminding the people of Israel of their covenant obligations. You're in a legal relationship, Israel, with God. You're in a covenant. And then verse 2, it uses the word assembly, the assembly of the people of God. And again, this is a deliberate word. It's reminding them, assembly means the called out ones. It's reminding them, you're separated. You're called out from amongst all the other nations. You're my people. You're God's people. So we're being reminded of who Israel are. They're God's special people. The scene we're being presented with, though, is one of a courtroom. Except you haven't just got one judge. The whole nation of Israel is acting like a judge. So in verse 3, they're the judge, and they ask questions of the witness, who is the Levite, where they say, tell us, how did this wicked deed happen? Picture the courtroom. They are the judge. Please would you present your evidence to the witness. So in verses 4 to 7, the Levite tells his story, and he basically recounts the events of chapter 19. He talks about these men of Gibeah who demand that the Levite man is brought out of the house so they can abuse him and molest him, but instead his concubine is thrown out to the wolves, into the darkness, and they abuse and molest her all night instead. And they leave her for dead, and the Levite takes the corpse, cuts it into 12 parts, sends it around Israel so everyone can see just what's been done by these men of Gibeah. I think it's probably worth mentioning, I think the Levite's being a bit selective with the truth here. There are details he misses out. One of the things he misses out is just how callously he's treated his own concubine up to this point. But nevertheless, he tells a bit of the story. He gives his witness statement. Verses 8 to 11, Israel, and not only the judge here, they're also playing the role of jury and executioner. So they decide to confront these men of Gibeah, and they're going to take huge numbers of people as a big operation. Verses 12 and 13, and then they go and they ask the whole tribe of Benjamin to give these men up. So Gibeah is one of the cities in the area and the region of Benjamin. So they go to the whole of Benjamin and they're saying, we want you to give up those men. What they did was wrong. They need to be put to death. They need to be punished. Justice needs to be served. But verse 13, notice what they say. This is important. This is the men of Israel speaking. They basically think, what they say is, we want these men that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. For them, it's as simple as that. If we deal with those people over there, if we deal with that particular hideous action, the sin, the evil from the whole of Israel will be purged. But it's just not that simple. What about everyone else's sin? Well, verse 13 to 17, the answer comes back from the men of Benjamin. No, we're not going to give them up. Verse 13, the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. Instead, they gather their own men for war. Verse 15, we're told they have 26,000 men who drew the sword. They've got 700 left-handed men who could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. They won't give up these. They're going to protect their own here. I think one of the things we're seeing here is tribalism at its worst. They'd rather defend perverted gang rapists than give them up. Because, well, no, they're our people. They're a part of our clan. So we'll defend them to the hilt. It's tribalism. It's dangerous. Dangerous tribalism. You know, tribalism is always dangerous. Wherever you see it, whether you see it in society, when you see it in the church, where you've got church lines being drawn by age or gender or social status or family loyalty. Tribalism is always dangerous, and you can see just how bad it is there. So, men of Benjamin, they're lined up, they're ready to fight. Put yourself in the shoes of one of these people in Israel for a minute. What would you do? You've gone up to them and you said, oi, give these people, give us that. And you've gone up and you've confronted them, and they say, no, we're not going to do it. What are you going to do about it? Do you know what we can be tempted to do sometimes? Is to sort of back down, slink away quietly a bit. Because actually, when it comes to it, we don't really want the fight, do we? We don't want an argument. You know, sometimes I just turn a blind eye to it. Do you know, see that with the, you know, he was talking about elections and so on. You can see that with politicians sometimes as well. I'll quote some statistics about it, and that'll show if I can pull up the right statistics. Look, we're doing something, but everyone knows the problem's still there. Well, God is going to deal with it. This chapter is showing us God's solution for sin. And he's going to deal with these people in Gibeah, that he's not going to paper over the cracks. He's not going to back down. Sin is going to be dealt with. And Israel are doing what's right here. This is what God had told them to do. So Deuteronomy 13, verses 12 to 16. God says to Israel, look, if you hear of any city in Israel that goes after other gods. I'm going to quote these verses for you because I want you to notice just how precisely this comes to pass. If you notice a city that sort of just goes away from God completely, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of the city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it, all that is in it and its livestock, with the edge of the sword. And you shall burn with fire the city and all its plunder for the Lord your God. That's Deuteronomy 13. We're going to notice some of those phrases like the edge of the sword. They come up by the end of the chapter. It happens. It burns with fire. So Israel is being summoned to carry out the role of executioner. Now, they're the ones who need to side with God and deal with Gibeah and now deal with Benjamin, because they're siding with the, they're protecting these wicked men. How do we apply something like that to ourselves? Does it maybe feel very far removed from our day and age? We're not called to engage in holy war, to pick up our swords and spears and things. Well, the principle of what's going on here is there is one part of Israel that has turned away from God completely and abandoned him. There's one thing we can say. When churches do that, when churches no longer hold to the Bible's core teachings, when they abandon the true faith as it's found in the Bible, do you know, we've got that same choice. Either we go for tribalism, well, they're part of our tribe, you know, we're in this denomination and we're going to stick with it because, well, it's our denomination, they're our people. Or we say, no, we can't have fellowship with them. They've abandoned Christ and what he stands for and his gospel. You know, we can't just brush it all under the carpet. God says what God's doing here is he's cutting them off, and we can't have fellowship. We can't work together in the gospel with people who don't believe and preach the same gospel. That's one way I think we apply that. So verse 18, the children of Israel ask God, which of us should go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? And the answer comes back, Judah first. God has said the same thing back in Judges chapter 1. The same question was asked and the same question was answered. But there is a difference. Back in chapter 1, Judah was to go up first against the Canaanites, the enemy out there, the idolaters, the people who sacrificed their babies to Moloch and did hideous, awful things. What's happening now? Judah is to go first up against one of their own, Benjamin. This is civil war now. This is Israel destroying itself, fighting within itself, trying to purge the sin from within. You know, everyone who dies in this battle is going to be an Israelite. And then what follows after that is a very long account of the war. If you're someone who really enjoys the sort of following skirmish details, and you can follow through and you can follow all the details of what happens when, if you enjoy sort of military history, it's a very long account, but we're just going to draw out a few of the main things. Basically, it happens in three waves. The first one is verses 19 to 22. They go out to fight against Benjamin, What's happened? What happens is they're raptured. They lose. So you look at verse 21, it says 22,000 of them die that day. So verse 23, they go back to God and they say, well, look, shall we go out again tomorrow? Shall we fight them again? And the answer comes back, yes. So they go out again. Verses 24 and 25. This is day two. And again, the same thing happens. This time they lose 18,000 warriors. What's going on? Well, see, on paper, they should have won this battle. Verse 17, we've been told they've got 400,000 men, and Benjamin only had 26,000 men. I get asked these sorts of questions all the time. But I was asked just this very afternoon in our home, and I'm not going to tell you who it was, but I'll give you a clue. It wasn't Roz who asked this, by the way. This afternoon it was, who would win the one best footballer in the world against the 11 worst footballers in the world? It's the sort of question I get asked all the time. Pretty much every day, it seems, lots of those sorts of scenarios. What if it was 1 against 100? What if it was 1 against 1,000? There's a little video you can watch on YouTube of 3 professional footballers play against 100, I think it's 11-year-old boys. And some of these scenarios you put and you think, well, it's obvious who's going to win. This one, you put it in the same category. 400,000 against 26,000. Who should win? Well, Israel should be winning. So they've got to ask the question, well, what's going on? Why do they keep on losing? That's the question they should be asking themselves. And to answer it, there's a link that we may well not spot, but Israel should have spotted. They should have been able to see what was happening. So often the Bible writers give us clues, they give us hints to something that's already happened. And with this one, what they should have seen was that it was the same thing that happened in Joshua chapters 7 and 8. In those chapters, the people of Israel are going into Canaan and they're trying to take the land. They'd marched around Jericho, remember the story of Jericho, the walls come down, and then they went on to a city called Ai. But in Ai, having defeated Jericho, they then lose there. It was a really serious failure. They end up being chased away by the men of Ai. But it shouldn't have even happened. After all, they were obeying God, they were taking the land. So why did they lose in Ai? Well, here's what happens. This is Joshua chapter 7, verse 12. Basically, God says to them, the reason you lost is because of your sin. There's someone within Israel who sinned, and you need to deal with him first. That's what they were told in Ai. And that's what they do. They work it out. They go through this process. It all filters down to one man named Achan. And Achan had taken some clothes, some silver, some gold. He'd hidden them in his tent. And so Israel dealt with him. They stoned him. They put him to death. And then, Joshua chapter 8, what happens after that? They go back and they fight against Ai again. And this time, they win. Now, can you see the parallels here? Can you see what they're meant to be thinking at this point? The Israelites need to think to themselves, this is Ai all over again. We keep on losing battles on paper we should be winning. Well, why? The message God's giving them is, you won't win until your own sin is dealt with. It's all well and good saying we'll deal with the sin over there of those people. What about yourselves? So verse 26, they weep, they fast, and they show these signs of repentance. And as far as we can see, I think we're meant to take it that it's genuine. Again, it's not straightforward for us to apply that. You know, how do we apply this to ourselves today? There's a danger that we try and draw a really straight line here, and we say something like, the reason we're not seeing more blessing in our lives, or in our church, or in our community, or in our nation, is because of our sins. And if we weren't sinning in such and such a way, then we would see particular blessing. It's easy to try and draw a straight line, but I don't think that line is quite as straight as we might want it to be, perhaps. I don't think it's as simple as that. But I do think it should make us ask that sort of question. Do we long for more of God's blessing? Do we long for his blessing in our own lives, personally? Do we long to know more of what it is to have the Holy Spirit in us? The joy of living with Jesus Christ every day. Do we want more of that blessing in our church? What about our nation? Do we plead with God that he bless our nation and turn many people to him? Well, I think it's right that we still ask that question. Is there sin we aren't dealing with ourselves? So for Israel, it's this double defeat that leads to those tears of repentance. Now, it's there that we reach what I think are the two key verses to this whole chapter. And in some ways, I think they're two of the most significant verses in the whole book of Judges. But they're verses we can skip over and miss. Verses 27 and 28. They bring burnt offerings and peace offerings. And notice that there is someone who is standing there. Verse 28. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron. Aaron was the first high priest in Israel. So it was his role once a year to go through the curtain into the Holy of Holies and to present the blood of these offerings to God on behalf of all the people of Israel for their sins. And that priesthood then followed through the family line. And it gives us that line there, Aaron to Eleazar to Phinehas. So we've got Aaron's grandson here. Now, we've seen a couple of Levites so far in this book of Judges, and they very clearly abandoned their God-given calling as Levites. They're meant to be teachers, they're meant to be carrying out that role in Israel, but they've abandoned their post. But verse 28, we're told Phinehas stood before it, the Ark of the Covenant, in those days. You see the significance of what's going on here. In spite of everything else, the chaos, the Levites, the leaders who have just jumped ship, there is still a high priest carrying out his role in Israel at this time. He's not abandoned his post. He doesn't just do it when he feels like it. He doesn't just jump to attention whenever he wants to. I think we're meant to sort of imagine it's almost like it's one of those battle scenes where you watch something like Braveheart, where everyone else is scared and running away from the enemy, but you've got that Braveheart Mel Gibson sort of moment. No, we'll stand. I'll stand. I'll fight. Everyone else is running away. Everyone in Israel seems to be decaying morally, doing whatever's right in their own eyes. But then you've got this one man, this high priest, who's still there, still ready to bring offerings for Israel. It brings us to the whole question of how does God deal with sin? Well, in the Old Testament, there was one way, a sacrifice of blood. Essentially, there were two choices for Israel. Either the people of Israel go up in flames, or the sacrifice does. So we've got that same picture for us today. In Jesus, we have a once-for-all sacrifice for sin. And that means the sacrifice doesn't need to be made again and again. And in Jesus, he's not only the sacrifice, he's the high priest too. And he stands on duty, and he never jumps ship, and he never goes absent without leave. In Jesus, we have a great high priest, a great sacrifice, and he's the high priest of a better covenant. When we come to sing in a few minutes' time, I'll quote one of those verses to you. It sums that up so well. He's the high priest of a better covenant. So it may well be that this whole discussion of sin, for you, we talked about it on a national scale. Maybe for you, you feel like one of those weeks where just personally, you feel you've been plunged into despair again. And you're just disgusted with yourself. How do I end up doing these things? I just want to go and scrub yourself in the bath for a while. You look at your sin and it just seems so obvious and think, how can that be dealt with again? And I think that's one of the reasons, one of the things we have judges for, where judges, it really does take us up to our eyeballs with sin. You know, we've gone through 19 whole chapters of it now, because in Judges 20, we're being taught once again, there is full forgiveness for sins available. No one too dirty, no one too rotten. And the reason for that is there is a high priest who goes and stands before God and pleads our cause. One of the points of Judges is, if the Israel of Judges can be washed clean, then so can we. Well, after that, verse 28, after that's happened, this time they get a different response from God. This time God says, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. They're going to go and pursue the Benjaminites again. And from this point onward, the victory is inevitable. There's this very long account then that goes into detail. I'm not going to go through all the details. All I'll point out to you that is significant, again, is that at every stage of the battle, it follows the battle that happened at Ai. So they both set up an ambush. They both feign defeat and lure the enemy out. They both attack and burn the city. Both times the enemy sees the fire and then they flee in panic. And both end with the slaughter of the enemy. And all the way through, we're meant to see those parallels, what happened at Ai. I'll just pick out verse 40. The Israelites set fire to the city of Gibeah, and a column of smoke starts to rise up. Remember that happened before? Destruction, where a column of smoke rises up. Sodom, Genesis 19, Abraham looks out towards Sodom and Gomorrah and he sees smoke coming up from the land. And what we're saying with chapter 19 is Israel, Gibeah, they've become like Sodom, but even worse. And then right at the end of the chapter, it ends, every city, man and beast are struck down with the edge of the sword. Remember those verses we quoted from Deuteronomy? Well, now it's happening. Now it's happened with the edge of the sword. It's a sad chapter in some ways. Because these are Israelites, the Benjaminites. They're Israelites, they're children of the promise. And when is it happening? Well, it's happening when Aaron's grandson is still on the scene. Within a couple of generations of them, going into the promised land of so many good blessings coming to them. And how quickly it's happened. So quickly it's all turned around. I think that's one of the reasons the Bible says so much about. It says things like, examine yourself. You know, these were Benjaminites. They were counted amongst the people of God. And you've got things like this in 2 Corinthians 13. Examine yourselves as to whether you're in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. It's worth reminding ourselves then, a time when a general election is imminent and where so many people are telling us, put your hope in me, in my party, in my politics, put your hope in human progress, in social reform, in science, in whatever it is. Examine yourself. Where is your hope? Is it in that one great high priest who deals with sin, the mediator, the great sacrifice? Or to examine ourselves again, is that where my hope is? But you know, the amazing thing about Judges 20, and we'll finish with this, the amazing thing about this chapter isn't that Gibeah went up in smoke. It's sad to read about. But that's not the highlight. The amazing thing is that Israel didn't join them. They started off saying, well, as long as we deal with them, all the evil in Israel will be dealt with. As in, well, I've not got a problem. The amazing thing is that Israel, after all they've gone through in Judges, that they don't go up in smoke too. And the reason is because of that high priest still standing there at the altar. The blood still flowing from the sacrifice. And the reason for us today, the reason we're spared and forgiven, is because we have that better high priest, the high priest of a better covenant, who offers himself. So that's where our hope has to be. Make sure nothing takes you away from that. So we're going to sing a hymn about Jesus.